So session four, we're going to talk about seeding and transplanting, and this gets into some real practicals of what to do in your garden. You're going to get our potting soil mix recipe, a whole bunch of really, really fun, good stuff in here. So quick overview is we're going to talk about direct seeding. That means seeding directly into the soil that that plant is going to grow in. We're going to talk about transplanting. That means starting your own starts inside or inside a hoop house or something like that. And then once they've grown for a few weeks, transplanting them out into your garden, how can you do that in a successful way? And why would you choose it to do it with one crop versus another crop? Why would you direct seed one versus transplant another one? We're going to talk about soil blocks. This is something that we have used a lot, and there's some real benefits to using soil blocks when transplanting. You will receive our potting mix recipe. And we'll talk about transplanting successfully. What steps do you take to have successful transplants? So let's jump right in and start out with direct seeding. Let me see what. Okay. So why direct seed? There are some crops where it's just not really practical, or this is economical. That's more on a farm scale, but like on a home scale even, it's just not... it's not time efficient, really, to transplant some plants. And examples of those plants are tap-rooted crops like carrots. You know, you're growing a lot of carrots in a small space, right? They're not spaced very far apart. So it's just not really time efficient to try transplanting them. So we direct seed them.
And also tap-rooted crops just don't generally transplant as well.
Yeah,
that's a general rule. It's not something we always follow, and I think Paul will have some other.
This might help us go back and forth easier.
Okay, think we'll have some other examples of tap-rooted crops that we do often transplant.
Yeah, we tend to transplant almost everything, and we'll tell you why. But there are a few things that we don't transplant. Let's maybe just put that over to the side. All right, so tap-rooted crops. This was pulled from a presentation that I did, and when it comes to a home garden, when we say low return per square foot crops, it's not as applicable necessarily in a home garden. Corn, pumpkins, believe it or not, we transplant our pumpkins usually, actually, so that shouldn't even be up there. But corn is one that's often direct seeded. Believe it or not, we have started transplanting corn. So you can go both ways with some of these, and there's some little tricks when it comes to transplanting. We can share some of those with you if you're interested. Legumes, peas and beans, we do direct seed those. It's more efficient to do it that way.
Again, they're not spaced very far apart, and you usually want to put a lot of them in, and it's not efficient to transplant those.
And then your fast-growing crops like radishes and spinach, we pretty much always direct seed our radishes. Spinach, we can go both ways. We actually transplant spinach quite a bit.
Yeah, we do.
So as you can see, some of it is personal preference. Find out what's most efficient for you and what you like to do the best. But some of them, we who are big proponents of transplanting, always direct seed, like carrots and peas and beans and radishes. So that's a quick overview of direct seeding. Herbs. So here's an interesting thing with herbs. Herbs can go either way, but there are several herbs that are tap-rooted herbs, like cilantro and dill, I believe is a tap-rooted herb as well. And they claim that it's better to direct seed them because the taproot does not like transplanting as much. That being said, we have transplanted those as well, and
our experience has been with the cilantro, though. I think that it tends to, it just doesn't do as well, and cilantro likes to bolt quickly.
Yeah,
and it seems that transplanting it encourages that even more.
Even more.
So you don't get a lot of life out of it, it seems.
Yeah. So recently we have been direct seeding especially the tap-rooted herbs. Cilantro. All right. So when it comes to direct seeding, germination percentages for direct seeding are actually lower than what they say on the packet. So the packet will probably say 80% germination rate, right? Or 90% germination rate. when you're direct seeding into your garden, often it will be a lower germination rate than on the packet just because of the environment in the garden. So we encourage you to allow what we call a fudge factor of about 50 to 100% germination. In simple terms, that means that if you want a plant every 4 inches, plant a seed every 2 inches, like double the amount of seeds that you're going to grow.
The reason for that is that when they get those germination numbers, they're germinating them in a very special controlled environment, and that's the numbers they get. But that's not the situation in your soil.
And so. You'll get closer to those numbers if you're starting transplants, because you'll be in a more controlled environment for those starts as well. Another thing is, like we mentioned in the very first session, seed is very inexpensive. So you can always plant more and then come and thin it out. I know that some of us have personalities that just really hate losing anything that's living, right? And so it's just, you can't throw it away, even if it's just a small thing. But honestly, when it comes to, maybe it's just growing on larger scales or on a farm or something, you get to the point where efficiency matters a little bit more, right? And it's actually very simple. One thing that you can do, a little tip, is that if you're growing, say, let's say radishes, you can plant them thickly, let them grow to like a baby stage, and then you can thin them and you can actually eat those thinnings. So if you don't want to waste the thinnings, you can actually eat them and still feel good about thinning your garden. And you get a little bit more harvest out of it too. So as a general planting rule, you want to cover seeds about 3 or 4 times their diameter. For example, if you have a pea seed that's about 1/4 inch in diameter, you'll want to plant that about 1 inch deep. And then any tiny seed, like, for example, radish seeds are pretty small. Carrot seeds are pretty small. All of those seeds are pretty small. Any of those little small seeds, you only want to cover them about 1/4 inch. So that's a general rule of thumb. If you're transplanting, by the way, lettuce seeds tend to germinate better without being covered. They're kind of a little exception to the rule. So that's just something to keep in mind. In cool or heavy soils, you can plant a little shallower. In warmer, dry soils, you can plant slightly deeper. Frankly, on a home garden scale, you won't necessarily need to pay attention to it, that much detail. So I would just stick with, think about 3 to 4 times the diameter of the seed itself. The main thing that you do want to pay attention to is you do want to keep that soil moist until they germinate. So make sure it stays moist, keep it watered until those seeds are germinating and coming up. And for, a week or two, especially as they are growing their first, when the seed is small, it's at its most vulnerable point of life, right? So you want to make sure and baby those little babies as they are just start growing.
Let me just share with you one trick that you can do to keep your ground moist, especially if you live in a very hot, dry place. We're going to talk about floating row covers in the season extension. That'll be our last session. And this is another use for floating row covers. You can just cover your recently seeded area and then water it. The water goes through the floating row cover, but it helps to conserve the moisture in the soil. That's the next best thing to having a mulch on. But, like if you've directly seeded something, a mulch is not really what you want on top of it. Remember that it helps to prevent things from growing. So you don't want that, but a floating row cover does work.
Yeah.
So
if you are direct seeding into a mulch, what you can do is kind of separate the mulch in your little row where you're going to plant those seeds, leave it separated until they establish themselves, and then you can mulch back around those plants. Yeah. So you can still do it with a mulch. It just takes a little bit of separation.
Yeah.
There are seeders, direct seeders on a home scale. If you're doing a larger garden, you would probably want to look into the Earthway seeder. It's one of the less expensive direct seeders. So you're welcome to write that down if you're interested in those. And then a nice way to keep nice rows in your garden is to string a string tightly down your bed and then just seed alongside it. And then makes a nice row in your garden. They also come, cedars also often come with a row marker arm on the side of the cedar that will mark the following row, so you keep your rows even. So that's kind of fun and nice just to keep an even, nice-looking row.
It's more than just cosmetics. If you're, you know, if you don't have a mulch on the soil and you're going to need to cultivate, or like if you're growing in a compost mulch, you know, if you've laid compost on the surface and you're growing in that, you may have a few weeds come up, and cultivation is so much easier if you have straight rows.
Yeah.
I can tell you that.
Yeah. Especially if you can fit your little cultivating tool just right between the rows, right?
Yeah.
All right. And then direct seeding by hand. This is what a lot of people will do on a home scale. Hand seeding is often used for larger seeds like legumes and corn. And frankly, I do it on our larger home scale, in teaching, we grow our own large garden, right? And we use it as a demonstration garden. And every month we do an update for our members on what's happening in our garden. And frankly, we have been seeding by hand, even our carrots and stuff like that, right? So you just take the seeds and sprinkle them out into your beds. But for the larger seeds, these are often, you can often hand seed these as well, like legumes and corn, bean peas, corn, all of those. All right, so let's talk about that. That is direct seeding. That's where you take the seed, you plant it right where it's going to grow to maturity in your garden. Let's talk about transplanting real quick. Transplanting, what are the advantages of transplanting? Why would you want to transplant? Why do we try and transplant as many things as we can, right? Number one, transplanting is more reliable overall. You have better plant care and cost efficiency because you are starting those starts in a more controlled environment, so you can take care of them a little better than if they're just right outside in your garden.
Just say something. Why is it more reliable? It's because what you transplant is most likely going to survive out in the field. You know, we've mentioned already you have a fair bit of loss when you direct seed, but you know, even if you're seeding your transplants, they may not all come up, but you're not going to put those ones that didn't come up out in the field. You know, you're putting the ones that are good out there. So you have a much more reliable, efficient stand of stuff in the field because you're just putting out there what worked already.
And remember, we said that, you know, at the plants, when the plant is just germinated and it's really small, it's at its most vulnerable stage. And so with the transplant, you've gotten past that most vulnerable stage. It's 2, 3, 4 weeks old now, and it's ready to go out, which means that you have a pretty high likelihood that it's going to survive and bear you fruit. Probably above 80%, it would be generous. I would say ours is probably 95%. Or maybe even a little higher. Yep. It's an almost sure harvest. That's just what we were talking about. Green manure productivity. I don't even remember why I put that in there. We will skip over that. It is easier to deal with weeds. I think the green manure productivity is that. So green manures are the same as another term for cover crops, where you grow a crop for, you know, healthy soil. And when you transplant, I think you can transplant into, like, if you're tilling that green manure into the ground, you can transplant into it sooner than you would direct seed into it.
Or you can just knock the cover crop down and then transplant into it as a mulch.
Yeah. Yeah, you could do that too. It's easier to deal with weeds with transplants because they already have a 3-4 week head start on any weeds that are there, right? So they're already ahead of the game. So it's going to be easier to deal with the weeds, and they will grow and fill up that garden bed space much faster, meaning they'll shade out any weeds that are wanting to come up. It increases the effectiveness of succession planting, like we were talking about before, because when you harvest one plant, you already have a 4-week-old plant that's ready to plant in its place. And that just means you get a lot more harvest a lot faster out of your garden than if you direct seeded into its place. And then shelter gives a head start, just having it in that sheltered environment. So there's many advantages. Let's talk about how to start your starts. Number one is germination temperature. So there's basically three things that you need for, to have good starts. There's three factors to seeds sprouting well. You have temperature, moisture, and light. Temperature, moisture, and light. Germination temperatures, the ideal temperature for most crops is between 70 to 75 degrees Fahrenheit or 21 to 24 Celsius if you like to use Celsius. Ideal temperature for asparagus, cucumber, eggplant, melon, peppers, and squash is actually a little bit hotter even, 75 to 80 degrees Fahrenheit. 24 to 27 Celsius. You'll be fine in the 70 to 75 range. So sometimes these numbers come out and they seem real specific. Frankly, there are a lot of crops that will germinate even at 60 degrees, right? There are greens, lettuce and stuff like that, that will germinate at 50 degrees. This isn't like a hard and fast rule, but in general, you'll get the best germination rates at this level. Does that make sense? So I don't want you to go away feeling like you have to have a temperature-controlled environment, you know, just precisely exactly. This is just what to shoot for. You'll do better. You'll have better germination rates.
If you have the ability to start your starts inside your house, that's the ideal temperature right there.
Most people keep their house at what, 70, yeah. 72? If you're real conservative,
68.
Maybe 60, 65. No, that's getting pretty cold, huh? Something that you can do is you can use a heat mat. These are not too expensive, I don't believe. You can just purchase a heat mat that goes underneath your starts as you're starting them. It just plugs into the wall, and that can keep them warm as they're germinating.
In particular, eggplant, tomatoes, and peppers might be helped with a heat mat.
With a heat mat. Yeah.
They really like it warm.
Those warm crops. Yeah. So there are three stages to transplanting, three stages. One is starting your starts. That's actually seeding them, getting them to germinate, etc. The second stage is an optional one, and that is potting on. We'll tell you a little bit more about what that is and what that's about. It's optional. We don't do it with everything that we transplant. And then the third is setting out or actually transplanting that crop into your garden space. So let's start with starting starts. Seeds are sown in some sort of bed or container, which usually holds a special soil mix or a potting soil in it. The soil mix that we use for starting our starts is different from garden soil. We don't just go take garden soil and start our starts with it. It has extra organic matter and drainage material in it. This helps the seedlings thrive despite the confined conditions when you're starting your starts. And then a controlled environment, like we just talked about in your home, greenhouse, cold frame, is used to enhance the growing conditions for young seedlings when you're starting starts. So there are different types of containers that you can start seedlings in. You can do individual pots, you know, like you go to the store and you buy a tomato in a pot, right? You can start your starts in those pots if you want to. You can do plug trays. That's something that is used quite regularly. They have individual cells that you start each plant in. Or you can use soil blocks. We're going to tell you a little bit more about soil blocks because there are some advantages to them. We prefer using soil blocks for most of our seedlings versus using plug trays and individual pots. And then the second part here is once you have your start started, potting on is when you transfer a seedling from its initial container into a larger one. So let's say you wanted to get some really early tomatoes. So you would start those tomatoes, but let's say you started it in a small container and it outgrew that container before it was ready to plant outside. So you can actually transplant that little start into a larger container for it to grow a little bit longer so that when it's ready to go outside, it will be a good place for going outside. So this is something that you would want to pay attention to, especially for crops that you're wanting to get an early start on them. Tomatoes is a good example. That's why I brought it up. And it's also something that you may want to pay attention to, for example, in a scenario where you planted your tomato where it should be at the right time to transplant out, but let's say you look at your weather forecast and there's 2 weeks extra of cold weather that you wasn't expected, right? You're getting some late frosts. This is a way that you can help that tomato not get stressed, because if it stays in its container too long, it will outgrow it and get stressed, and it will stunt its growth. So this is a way that you can prevent that, is by potting it on into a larger container. All right, we covered that. Then the third one, setting out, is planting your young starts into the field or greenhouse where they will grow, or out in your garden space. The more efficiently this transfer is done, the more effective and the less work transplanting is. So let's talk about what are soil blocks, because I mentioned to you that we like to use soil blocks. How many of you have used soil blocks or know what soil blocks are? Okay, there's a few of you. All right. So what are soil blocks? Soil blocks is a block made out of lightly compressed potting soil, and it serves both as the container and the growing medium for that transplant. Okay, both the container and the growing medium. The blocks are pressed out by a form, and the airspace between the blocks serve as little walls between them. It's not much airspace. I mean, their blocks are just, they're frankly almost touching each other, but it does make a little air gap wall between the blocks.
What happens is the roots grow inside that soil block, and when they reach the edge and find air, they stop. It's called air pruning. They just stop there. If you're growing in cells or in some sort of a pot, when the roots reach the edge of the pot, they just start circling around, and then you get a root ball, and it's not as healthy. But this way, they just stop at the edge, stop growing that direction.
Yeah,
and continue their growth otherwise.
If you get a transplant that has started that circling, there's actually a term for it. It's called root bound, where that plant, when you transplant it out, it'll be root bound because all of those roots, they don't know where to go, right? They've just been circling, and it takes a little while for that plant to start figuring out where to start sending roots afterwards. So even with a soil block, if you leave the plant in too long, eventually that root will jump to the next block. But the cool thing is that even in that case, you can pull them apart and those roots are still all pointing outwards. So when you transplant it, they immediately are ready to keep growing outwards in the soil. Another thing with soil block is the roots of the seedlings quickly fill the soil block, holding it together. So it kind of binds the soil block together. So it's not, you might think that this is just a block of soil. It's just going to fall apart. But they're actually, once the plant has grown in it for a little while, it's actually quite firm and handles pretty well. It's not too fragile. There are a nice thing about them is that you don't have these plastic pots or plug trays to deal with. You will want to have some type of tray that you are putting your soil blocks in. The thing about plug trays is often they tear by the end of the season, or when you're pushing the plants out. If you're really careful, you can reuse them, but they tear pretty easily, and then you're constantly buying new trays. With soil blocks, you can have just a tray that is reusable over and over again that you start your seeds in. And then blocks can be made in various sizes to meet your potting needs. They have forms of everywhere from 3/4 inch to 1.5, 2, 3, and 4 inches.
So the little tiny ones and the red ones up there, those are specifically for germinating the seeds that you're going to grow on a heat mat so that you can have more seeds on the heat mat at once.
Yeah.
That's the reason for those. And then those, as soon as they're germinated, you have to pot them onto a larger pot it's not big enough to grow in at all.
So for most home gardeners, we would suggest the 1.5 or the 2-inch block size. So that's what I would go for. And these are larger soil blocks forms. You can get a simple hand form that is just one row of soil blocks. And that's really all that most home gardeners will need for doing a smaller size garden.
Yeah.
All right. So how would you like to know our secret potting mix recipe? No, it's not actually secret, but it is a potting mix recipe that we have used over the years that has been very successful, and we'd like to give it to you. I guess it is secret if you don't know it yet. No. potting mix recipe. So I'm going to give you three, a full recipe, and then I've done the math for you to do a half recipe or a quarter recipe. The reason is our full recipe is what we used to do on the farm, so that makes a lot of soil blocks, so might be a little overkill for you, right? So depending on how many starts you're wanting to start, you might want to cut it in half or even cut it in a quarter. Here's the recipe. So number one, is peat moss, and you can see the numbers up there for, let's just go for our example here. We'll do the half, so the half recipe, okay? So we'll talk about the half recipe. So you're going to use 3 gallons of peat moss. You're going to use 3 gallons of compost. So those are equal, peat moss and compost. You're going to use 1 gallon of coarse perlite. 1 gallon of coarse perlite. The perlite is those little white granules. If you've ever seen a potting mix, even ones that you buy from the store that little starts are started in, the little white granules, and those help with drainage and soil retention in a potting mix. And then you'll use 1 cup of a fertilizer mix. A little note here is that a 2 gallon bucket works well for measuring, or even a 1 gallon, just a little bucket. You can find them at your local hardware store. So it's a very simple recipe, and I will tell you about the fertilizer mix in just a second. But like you see here, peat moss, compost, perlite, and fertilizer. Very simple, very easy to mix together. We do not have experience with this personally, but you could, if you wanted to, replace the peat moss with a coconut core. Coconut core is basically ground up coconut hulls, and it's very similar in texture and to peat moss. So you could do that if you wanted to. All right, a fertilizer mix. We used to mix our own fertilizer mix together, but frankly, it would be a lot easier for you to use this vegan mix. This is Down to Earth vegan mix, and we've used it very successfully. It is an organic OMRA-listed fertilizer mix. It's 100% plant-based. Now, we are not, as you may have guessed from our previous presentations, we are not 100% against using animal sources in our garden, right? Because we believe that God did create natural cycles in nature that includes animals. The issue with fertilizers is that often, for example, when it comes to blood meal, feather meal,
cow manure that's bagged,
a lot of these come from CAFOs, which are large centralized feeding lots of animals. And frankly, they pump up those animals with all kinds of antibiotics, all kinds of who knows what, immunizations, you know. The list can go on and on, probably, of what ends up in those animals. And we don't know, you know, what's going to end up coming back into our garden. And we just generally try and shy away from, and plus we don't really want to support those industries. So it's kind of a double-edged thing there. So that's why this is kind of nice in that it's 100% plant-based. It has an excellent balance of nutrients. It includes soybean meal, canola meal, alfalfa meal, rock phosphate, langbeinite, green sand, kelp meal, and humic acids all mixed together. So those are all very natural sources of nutrients that your plants can take up. All right.
And I would just say again, we did... with our original fertilizer mix, used blood meal. So that, you know, that's one animal source you can use. You're not going to use cow manure in here. Blood meal is a good nitrogen source, but this fertilizer mix makes it really easy to escape using that if you want to.
And by the way, it is readily available online. It may or may not be at your local garden center. Oftentimes, Down to Earth does have some of their products at local nurseries and garden centers and stuff like that. But this particular product may or may not be, but it is very easily readily available online. You can get it shipped straight to your door, and it's really not that expensive. All right, so this isn't the only recipe. There are other, you know, other people have mixes that work well as well, but this is one that has worked well for us over the years. And that's what I would start with. If it works, why try and figure out a new one, right? Then what you want to do is, after you've mixed it together, you mix it dry, the ingredients dry, then you want to moisten it with water by adding an approximate ratio of about one part water to three parts of the dry mix. And really, this is by feel. You're going to wet it down. It's better in the end for your soil blocks to be a little bit more wet than dry. And you can always add, like if it gets too wet, you can always add a little more compost, add a little more dry peat moss to dry it out a little bit as you're doing it. In the end, it should be like a wrung out sponge. That's the moisture level that you want. So when you pick up a handful of it and you squeeze it together, you might get a few drops that drip down, but it's not going to just be like seeping water, right? So moist like a wrung out sponge. Then you're going to use your soil blocker. You push it down quickly and kind of twist it around, just jamming the mix up into those forms. And you can push it as hard as you want. They will not overcompact. Because of the peat moss and the structure of the compost and the peat moss together with the perlite, it will not overpack. So you can mash it as hard as you want. And you just want to fill those forms. Then you scrape off any excess that is on the bottom of the form, and then you can eject those blocks into a tray or a flat, as you can see in the picture here. It is an option. You can rinse your little form in water between each use. That can sometimes help with just keeping good uniform blocks. Although, frankly, in my experience, I have done it many times without rinsing it between each use. If it starts getting stuck, your form starts getting stuck and not ejecting them very well, then it would be a good idea to rinse it out.
The main thing is that you want to rinse it clean after you're finished. Definitely. Making your blocks, because if you don't, it'll corrode very quickly.
Yeah, they will rust.
Rust. Yeah.
Rust over time. All right, so now you have your starts. You started them. You got your little soil blocks. Let's talk about transplanting them out into the field, transplanting successfully. There is a process with transplanting called hardening off. This is because when you start your starts inside, they're in a protected environment, and outside, it's an unprotected environment. So they haven't experienced winds. They haven't experienced harsh sunlight, right? So you want to get your seedlings accustomed to the outdoors. Otherwise, they can experience what's called transplant shock, where they've just been planted out in a new environment and they've got all these other things going on. So hardening off is the process of gradually exposing your sheltered seedlings to the outside elements. There's a very simple way to do this that we've had really good success with. There are some people that kind of prolong this process, but frankly, we've had very good success with what I'm going to share with you today, which is much shorter and simpler than some hardening off methods. On day one, you're going to place your starts that are inside, place them out in mid-afternoon, and leave them out until mid-morning the next day. So they're not left, you don't place them out in the middle of day when it's the harshest sunlight. But wait till it's mid-afternoon. It's still kind of a medium harshness of sunlight, right? And leave them out all night until mid-morning the next morning. And then on day two, you're going to bring them inside at mid-morning, leave them in over the middle of the harshest part of the day, the middle of the day, and then you will transplant them out that evening on day two. And we've frankly had very good success with this, with hardening off our starts this way.
Evening is the nicest time to transplant as well, because it gives them the night to kind of settle in and get adjusted. And when the next day comes, they're a little bit more ready for it than if you plant them mid-morning, for example, and then they're faced with the heat of the day, and they just got in, and they don't like that very well.
Yeah. All right, so a couple other tips with transplanting successfully is you do want to water them well. It's important that the seedlings be watered well before transplanting. You want them to be very moist when you're transplanting them out. It's also important to water them immediately after transplanting. The moist ground helps that transplant to take root faster and become established in its new environment. So water, water, water. Water before and after you transplant them into the ground, water them again.
Watering it also will help the soil to settle in around them so that they have better contact. You know, sometimes if you're, especially, you know, when we're trying to transplant a lot of transplants and do it quickly, they don't always get settled in as nicely as they could. But watering overhead, a good amount of water helps to settle the soil
settles
in around
it down.
Them.
Yeah. Then avoid disturbing the roots as much as possible. Many plants, I mean, frankly, it's a good idea to avoid disturbing the roots as much as possible. I'm just remembering many times that we transplant, you know, we're not standing there like OCD about, you know, I've got to be very careful and very carefully place the plant in and don't move anything. You know, you can do that if you want to, but many plants will handle a little bit of disturbance as you're moving it and transplanting it in. They're going to be okay, right? They want to grow. Just be sensitive and try not to disturb them as much as possible. You're less likely to disturb the roots of a seedling grown in a soil block because the roots are air pruned than one that has been in a plug tray and the roots have been circling for quite some time.
You know, as Paul said, those soil blocks really hold together. By the time you're ready to transplant, we have, you know, taken a tray of transplants and we mark out the ground where we want to transplant them. So we've got markings on the ground. I know where I want each one to go. And you can actually take a block and drop it onto the ground where it's supposed to be. And they don't fall
apart.
They
stay together.
They hold together. Yeah.
Yeah. And
whereas a plug won't necessarily do that. I wouldn't trust a plug so well.
Yeah. One exception to this is if you have a very root-bound plant that has been grown in a pot or a plug tray that has like the roots have circled around a lot, and you pull it out, it is actually a little bit better to break up those roots a little bit.
Yeah.
When you put it in, it will help them to grow out better.
Yeah.
Yep. All right, soil contact. You want to just dig a little hole with a trowel, place the soil block lightly but firmly in the ground, avoid air pockets and uncovered edges. Even if a corner, you really want to, an important little step here is that when you transplant it in, you want to cover that soil block, or even the same would hold true with if you were transplanting from a plug tray or another pot. You want to cover it with soil. Cover the whole thing with soil. If the top of the soil block or whatever your plant has been growing in is left out, that potting mix can dry out very quickly and very easily. So covering it with soil helps to just keep that moisture in. And then, of course, if you're mulching around that, that's going to be helping it as well. All right, proper spacing. By properly spacing your transplants, you're making an optimum use of the land area. And we are going to give you in the resources what we call our ultimate garden cheat sheet. It's basically a list of common crops that you grow in the garden. And we list on there our suggested plant spacings for you. So you could just take that and use that for optimum spacing in your garden. Weeding and cultivating is more efficiently when your plants are properly spaced, like we talked about with the direct seeding. Right? Mm-hmm. Transplanting is going to be a similar scenario if you're going to be doing that. One way that you can easily mark out your beds is with a marker rake. This is probably one of the easiest ways. You get a rake like on the right-hand side here. This is an example of a tool that is made for a 30-inch wide bed. It's one of the lightest weight rakes that you will probably find. And
don't confuse it with a landscape rake. We got a landscape rake and nobody wants to use that rake. This is very light, and it's so easy to use.
Yeah, you can swing it around with one hand.
Johnny sells these. That's the only place I know you can buy them.
But. And what you do here is, see these little red markers? You just cut little sections of PEX pipe. Do we have any builders around here? PEX pipe is just is a plastic pipe that is used in hardware for water lines in the house and stuff like that. You can find it at any hardware store.
It's flexible.
But yeah, it's slightly flexible.
It's sold in rolls.
And you just cut little sections of it, a little longer than your tines, you know, maybe 5 inches or so. And then you just push them onto the tines, the spacing that you want, and you can use it to mark your bed. And then you can mark a grid pattern in your bed. So we will mark how many rows we want in that bed, and then we'll come back and mark a grid with it, and then we can easily plant our plants out at the right spacing.
If you don't have PEX pipe lying around, it's probably not worth it to invest in a roll just to get these. Johnny's Seeds does sell little pre-cut ones. That, yes?
They sell it 5-foot sections.
Do they?
Yes.
If you can find a 5-foot section, that's probably the cheap. Because those ones that Johnny sells, somebody's making good money on those.
Yeah, no, it'll be much cheaper to get a 5-foot section at your hardware store.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. You want to talk about transitioning?
Okay. Yeah. So we're going to talk now about, if you're wanting to try a no-till approach, how do you transition from one crop to the next? You know, this was a big question in my mind when I first started thinking about this. It took me a while to wrap my mind around it. So we're talking about how do you transition, for example, from a cover crop to your vegetables, or even how do you transition from one kind of vegetable to another, you know, as you're making your rotations? How can we do that without digging, without tilling our soil? Is this?
Should be going.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay, so the first thing that you can do, each of these steps will not be necessary every time, but you know, in every situation is a little bit different. So these are things that you can just kind of keep in the back of your mind and think about. If you have weeds growing in that space that you want to put a crop in, that have seed heads or are nearly to go to seed, the best thing you can do is take them out by hand, okay? You do not want your weeds going to seed in your bed.
By the way, like for example, there is a weed called pigweed. I don't know if any of you are familiar with pigweed. A single plant of pigweed can have like 30,000 seeds on it. So if you don't want weeds in your garden, you want to be proactive to keep that weed from going to seed.
Yeah. Okay, the next step, once you've made sure you've taken out any potential weeds that are going to seed, is to knock down or cut the established crop. So if you have a cover crop, as you can see in the picture here, This is the cover crop we talked about earlier this morning that we had growing last winter in some of the beds in our hoop house. It's wheat and peas. And I'm using a scythe there to cut it down. I didn't want to use a mower because I don't want it all blown out. And I wanted to try a scythe too. To be honest, some of these old technologies have their place, I think, still, even now. So I cut it down with a scythe. You could also knock it down, but if you knock it down, you need to figure out a way to crimp it. we mentioned that the big farmers use what they call a roller crimper. They'll run over it with that. On a small scale, one way that you can crimp it is to take a T-post. You know what a T-post is? A metal fence post. And it's going to be a two-man job, but you just tie two ropes on the T-post, and each one person holds one rope on one side and one person holds a rope on the other side, and you take that T-post and set it down, and then you both stomp on it, and then you lift it up with the rope and move it forward like a foot or two and set it down, and then you both stomp on it so that it'll crimp the stuff that you're laying down in the bed in front of you.
We'll also share with you an easier way, though it might take a little bit longer to knock it down and kill it as well.
Yes. Yeah. So you can. Oh, okay. So you can knock down or cut the established crop using these methods. One is a flail mower. Now, most of us as home gardeners are not going to use a flail mower. It's a implement that has blades that are spinning this way. They're actually little flails on a chain, and they're rotating this way, a number of them on a bar. And it's one description I read said it's a chopper shredder on wheels. That's a nice description. You can run a flail mower over a cover crop 6 or 8 feet tall, and it just shreds it into little pieces. That's very, very nice. But again, you need to have at least a walking tractor, a two-wheeled, like a BCS walking tractor or something like that. You can get flail mowers that go on them. It's quite an investment for the home gardener, and I don't think you need to do that. It's not really realistic. You can use your mower, your lawnmower. If you have a lawnmower that has a mulching attachment so that it drops the cuttings down instead of throwing them out, I would recommend that. I don't like you're not wanting to throw the cuttings out.
If you have a lawnmower that collects your cuttings, then that's
another
that,
option
that
too.
Can work good too.
Yeah. You can use a scythe like I did, or you can use a roller crimper. And again, I think the roller crimper is kind of hard on the home scale, or you can use a T-post crimper like I just described. If you have several options, then once you've cut it down, you can either take it out and compost it, or you can leave it as a mulch on your bed. Okay? I took that one out and composted it here. You can see I've got some old round bales that are rotted. And so I just lay my my cover crop down in a layer, and then I laid old hay on top of it in a layer, and then cover crop in a layer, back and forth. And I also throw a little bit of soil. I'd put the hay bale down and then the cover crop, throw a little bit of soil on, and I had some compost that had weeds growing on it. I just took the weeds and the soil, the compost, and threw that on the layer, and then put my next layer of hay down and build that about this high, something like that, and then let it compost.
You'll also want to, with each layer that you put down, you'll want to wet it down with a hose, get it nice and moist as you're building that compost pile.
Yeah, it doesn't work dry.
The key, real quick here, since we don't have a specific session on composting with you all, the key to composting is to get those layers of what we call brown and green. So the fresh cover crop that my dad was putting on would be a green layer. It hasn't dried out yet, and it's going to be higher in nitrogen. The old straw hay bale is a brown layer. It's been dried out for, who knows how many months. And you want to layer those together and actually have probably about two parts dry brown to one part of the wet green.
Yeah.
Don't get that confused. You do want to wet your whole compost pile down with water. I'm just describing the two.
Yes. Yeah. The other thing that you can do is use a tarp, a silage tarp. You'll want to do this especially if cutting is not going to kill the crop that was there. So, for example, we had the wheat growing, and grasses aren't normally killed by cutting, and so we covered it those beds with a silage tarp after we took the compost off, and we left them that way for about 3 weeks. They were killed, and we transplanted into them.
A silage tarp is basically a thick plastic tarp, and it's just solid plastic.
It's white on one side, black on the other. The main thing is that what you're covering with cannot let any light through, and it kills by occultation is what they call it. It you know, the plant has to have light to live, and by being covered, it doesn't get the light.
So you may wonder, like, can I use just a regular tarp from the store? Well, it's going to depend on if it allows light through. Some of those tarps from the store, if you put them up to the sun, you can see the light coming through, right? So that's not going to work as well. You may be able to find a tarp from the store that is completely solid, but that's just the main consideration.
Yes. Tarping will not work on plants that have deep tap roots or that are perennials. We have Johnson grass. Do any of you know what Johnson grass is? It's you have big root runners down 2 feet deep, and it's terrible. So several years ago I had a lot of that in a place I wanted to grow on. I left the tarp on it for about 3 months, and that seemed to take care of it. But, you know, it's a long process.
Someone was asking earlier about dealing with grasses, and I said I was going to share a short story. My uncle, Uncle Rob Neal, he has a garden, and he had a real problem with nut grass. I don't know if any of you have nut grass where you are, but it's a very invasive grass. And he took half of his garden and he covered it with a tarp for an entire season, for like all summer long. And then he grew in the other half. And then he swapped the next season. And he said that he probably cut down his nut grass by 80%. So it really was very effective. So if you have an invasive grasses like that, that is an option that you can look into. It does take time, because you're going to have to just let it sit there because they're so persistent in coming up. But give it long enough, it will eventually kill what's underneath.
We have a question back here.
What does that do to your soil health?
You know, yeah, the disadvantage is that you don't have roots in the ground. You have it's like a bare fallow. And so that's not going to be as good for your soil health.
Yeah. The flip side advantage is that it does keep your soil moist like a mulch. So like it would be best to have roots in the ground, like a living thing in the ground. But the next best option is to keep your soil covered with a mulch. And the tarp acts similar to a mulch. So the life in the soil can continue to grow and... You know, it's not going to grow like it would with roots in the soil, but it will. It's not going to die off as much. It keeps that moist environment where they can still grow and thrive. Yeah. So I'm just going to repeat the question so that people listening later. The question was, would it be best to throw mulch on there first and then cover it with a tarp? And actually, when we are talking about, for example, let's say you have that cover crop and then you're wanting to prepare it to plant into, you can just knock that cover crop down and throw the tarp on top of it and let it kill off that cover crop, and that cover crop acts as a mulch underneath. So that would be a very, very effective way. Another one is like with the – well, we did it with the with that cover crop, but then I was thinking about our strawberries, but I guess you just ended up covering them with plastic.
I've, we are making some new beds. You know, my wife and I have been gardening with Paul and Natasha down near their place, and our house is about half a mile away. We're wanting to establish some gardens at our house, and we just bought some mushroom compost, and we laid it about 4 inches thick on top of our lawn, just straight on the grass. Now, I wasn't convinced that it would kill the grass underneath, and so we decided to tarp it. And we have looked under the tarp. In fact, we had the tarp we used was old and it was falling apart, so we replaced it. And when we replaced it, we could see grass was already trying to grow up through the mulch, but tarping it was, you know, the idea with tarping was to make sure we killed the whatever was underneath.
One thing my wife Natasha and I are planning to do for this next spring is we have several more of those old hay bales out there. We're planning to mulch where we want to put our garden with that hay, but we know that it has a lot of weed seeds in it. So we're going to mulch it probably early spring and then tarp it, let some of those weed seeds grow and sprout, but under the tarp so that it kills those off. And then when we're ready to transplant our garden into it, we'll just pull the tarp off and transplant into the mulch. Yeah.
One thing I need to say, whenever you're using the tarp, you want to make sure that it's very wet underneath before you put the tarp down, because you're wanting to encourage whatever is there to try its best to grow, because that's the way that you'll be able to kill it, is if it tries to grow. If it's not wet and so the seeds aren't germinating, you know, the weeds aren't trying to germinate and things aren't trying to grow, your tarping is going to be much less effective. Okay, so the next part here is actually preparing your beds. If you, you know, once you've taken care of whatever was growing there first, I mainly talked about cover crops, but if you had vegetables or something growing in, you can cut them down, take out the residue, put it on your compost pile. Like I said, I really like the idea of leaving my roots in the ground. So I cut off the lettuce or the kale or tomatoes or whatever. I'm using clippers to cut them off and leaving my roots in the ground and putting the residue on the compost pile. And then if it's something that is going to want to regrow, then we'd tarp it. But widely spaced transplants don't need any cleaning. You can have residue in your bed if you're going to transplant into it. Like if you're going to transplant tomatoes, you're going to put them, 1 to 2 feet apart, and so you can just go through the mulch and make a hole for them and transplant them into it. But if you're having more closely spaced things, it's not really practical just to make individual holes in the mulch. It's easier to clear it all the way off and put those in the ground. And then if you're direct seeding, Paul already said one way, if you have a mulch on the ground and you're wanting to direct seed, you can just pull it apart and seed into that. But if you're wanting to do something like a bed of baby lettuce or a bed of carrots where you have a number of rows not too far apart, that's not really practical either. It's probably just going to be easier to skip the mulch altogether and do it straight in the ground. The removed plant material can be put on the compost pile. So then the next step would be to, if you're going to do any amending, you can do it here.
That means if you're going to add any more compost onto your bed, or if you have any natural nutrient, you know, rock powders or whatever that you want to add to your bed, that would be an amendment that you would add on.
Yeah. So at this stage, once you've cleaned the bed ready for things, then you can put the amendments on. And again, using a no-till approach, we're just putting them on the surface. And we're relying on the life of the soil to mix it in and take advantage of it. And it will do that. The earthworms and other things, they mix it all up. I guess that's
I think
it.
That's the end.
Then so you're ready to plant.
So we talked about mulching with a whole bunch of different mulches, like, you know, straw and wood chips and stuff like that. If you want to just garden in the most, if you want to do no-till gardening, but the closest to just regular gardening without all these mulches, then I would just point you back to where we talked about using a compost mulch.
Yeah.
You know, you will have to purchase larger amounts of compost because you're going to use that compost as a mulch, and you need it to be 3, 4, maybe even 5 inches thick on your bed to act effectively as a good mulch to help keep that weed pressure down. But then with that compost mulch, you can seed directly into it. You can transplant into it very quickly. You don't have to be pulling mulch apart to put your transplants in because you can just do it directly into the compost if you use the compost as a mulch. So that's probably one of the easiest ways to do a no-till garden on a home scale without dealing with trying to tarp cover crops and stuff like that. Just mulch it with compost.
Yeah.
All right, so it is 2:36. We will start again at 2:45. Do we want to just grab a couple questions? Is there anyone that has a couple questions? Yes. No. Okay, so are there any charts for watering so you know not to overwater or underwater, but specifically overwatering in this case?
I don't know. As far as I can tell, you know, unless you have moisture meters and things like that, watering is really an art that you have to learn.
So yeah. let's try and make it as simple as possible, right? When you're starting your starts, your transplants, I'll tell you what we do. We generally water them once or maybe twice a day if it's real hot. One simple way that you can do it is you can go to your transplant, the little, it's really nice with soil blocks because you can actually touch them. You know, when it's in a plug tray, you can't really see underneath that plug tray. You know, how is it really dry under there or not? You know, it's a little bit harder. But with a soil block, you literally just pick up the soil block. You can feel how moist it is. And if it's starting to feel like it's drying out, you water it. If it feels really wet, you know that you don't need to water it, right? And same thing, once they are planted in the ground, literally you can just go and push your finger down into the ground and feel, does the ground feel moist? If it feels moist, then wait a day to water. If it feels like it's starting to dry out, you know, water it. So, you know, it is to a certain extent an art that's learned, but there are simple things that you can do to try and gauge if it's getting too much water or if you need to wait. Any advice on automatic watering systems?
No, we have not used them, but I know that there is a young man here by the name of Caleb Whiting who is developing one. I haven't talked to him recently, so I don't know exactly what stage it's at. But
he's developing one. You know, I don't know. It would be a significant investment for a home gardener. It's more for small farms. But the nice thing about his is that it has a moisture meter, so it's only going to water when the moisture level gets to most automatic watering systems that are out there right now, especially like on a home scale, is just the one you put on the hose and you say water 30 minutes every day. If your garden's outside and it gets a bunch of rain, then you don't really need to be watering it those 30 minutes, right? And it may get too much water, etc. So those are some of the complications that you face with automatic watering. Was it a problem to use shower water, pipe it out to the garden?
Again, you know, the watering is something where you need to really be aware of your context. You know, there are situations where that would probably work very well and other situations where it wouldn't. So, you know, it's hard to give broad advice on watering. And it's not just the season also. For example, in our environment stays pretty moist all winter long. And so we hardly ever water in the winter. We do need to keep an eye on it in the hoop house, but even the hoop houses, we very rarely water because moisture just sits in the ground. In the summer, it's a different story. So, you know, you have to keep those kind of, the seasonality things in mind as well. You have to be really attuned to temperature, evaporation, and, you know, what's going on in the bigger world out there that's going to be affecting my soil.
I will say this when it comes to shower water specifically is that most soaps kill biology. We'll talk about that when we talk about pests because you can actually use soap as a natural insecticide. You know, it's a direct contact one. But so, you know, if you have a bunch of soap residue, you won't necessarily want that running into your garden.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, or eggshells good for compost. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They are a great source of calcium for your garden. We have one over here.
The more crushed up, the better, of course.
Yes, yeah.
Well, those squares that you saw in the tray come out of that machine. Those were the soil blocker machines. We were doing it in a long tray, you know, like they sell at the hardware store for mixing mud. Yeah. So these are, you know, for the home gardener, these are pretty expensive. They're pretty pricey.
Well, these large ones are.
Yeah, they're over $200. And you're making more blocks than you're going to really need on a, you know, for your home garden at one time. But like we said, they sell hand blockers that will just be one row here. And
yeah.
And that's this size here. And those are in your price range and they're a, you know, make an amount that's very reasonable for you to use.
Yeah, we have one. I need to get a picture of it so I can put it in.
I think my brother actually borrowed ours to bring here. Yeah. So you might find him and look at it. Yeah.
It would be a similar principle, yeah.
I think it's going to be very similar. I don't have a lot of experience with those. But,
Yeah, we don't have experience with how effective, like, compared to our potting mix recipe, the peat pellet is. I don't know what nutrients they have in them already or if they have nutrients in them. So there's those things that we don't know, but the same principle would be applicable.
I will say we compared soil blocks to plug trays. One time we used the same potting mix, the same seeds from the same packet in soil blocks and plug trays seeded all at the same time. And within 2 weeks, there was a very visible difference in the size of the plants growing in each one. The soil blocks were much bigger and more vigorous than in the plug tray. And so that convinced us we don't need plug trays.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.